It went straight down the middle. Then it started to...
So take us through that decision process you went through about deciding to try the tour qualifying school and turn professional.
Well, I had wanted to turn professional back in 63, but that's when I hurt my right hand, and I really literally couldn't, I couldn't play in enough tournaments to make it work. And, you know, back, that was the dark ages of medicine. I went to several doctors. I ended up in New York. I lived in Maryland, went up to New York to the hand specialist at New York Hospital for Special Surgery. They had a hand clinic up there, and they treated me with injections, and they decided that in order to be able to play golf, they would put it in a cast that was a removable cast, so that I would it was pretty immobile until I took it off to play golf. And every time I used it, it got inflamed. And when it got inflamed, then the wrist area, your tendons for your fingers ran under what is called the carpal ligament. And when that inflamed, that pushed the tendon up there, and it hurt like hell. Yeah. So I had pain in my right hand for anytime I started to practice or play in tournament, by the time Sunday got around, I was hurting like a dog. So it was impossible for me to play professional golf while I had that. So I'd hurt it in 63. As a matter of fact, I hurt it so bad in 63. I was invited to play in the Masters. I couldn't play in 63 because of my right hand. I finally, in desperation, I was playing in a tournament in Mexico, and I was leading on the last round, going to the 12th hole, and hit a shot, and I couldn't finish. So that's when I went back to New York. And actually, the doctor was named Rolla Campbell, and it was Bill Campbell's brother.
So small world.
Yeah, small world. So I told him that they just didn't know what to do with it, and they'd been treating it for almost 4 years or 3 years, and so he decided to go in and do an exploratory surgery, and I did want to turn professional, but it was physically impossible. So he went in and did surgery and found out and cleaned up all the scar tissue and everything. And he literally couldn't fix what the problem was because I had unusual build of my arms. I had very long extender tendons and short muscles in my right forearm. And it was a little unusual. So what he did was he took the carpal ligament and clipped the carpal ligament and transplanted it underneath a couple of the tendons that hurt. And after that, I still had inflammation, but it didn't hurt anymore.
Amazing. And,
so after that surgery, I went down to Florida in March and played in a couple of events. I believe I played in Orlando or played in a South Florida amateur tournament, played in Orlando in a tournament, a tour tournament in Orlando, and found out I could practice and play, and then played in the Masters tournament in 66. And following the Masters, I had been named to the Walker Cup team for the fifth time. I sat down with Joe Dye at Augusta and told him after my surgery, I was able to now practice and play more than just a few events a year, and that I was going to turn professional. So that's how it happened.
Ah, interesting, Dean. I didn't know that at all. That's great.
Well, of course, postscript of that is I'm one shot out of the lead of the U.S. Open, where Trevino won, and Marion, and I get to the 16th hole, and then rough on the right side and trying to hit it out of the deep rough on the right side of 16. I ripped my left hand.
Oh, God.
And then I had the same problem with my left hand and ended up with surgery there again in 72, a couple of years later.
Isn't that something?
You know, Bruce, for anybody that's played this game for an extended period of time, particularly professionally, I can't imagine there's too many guys that have gone through many years without having something go on with their body.
Well, you know, some of us have been very lucky. I had one, just quickly, I had one real problem with my left shoulder, and I had to withdraw from the Canadian Open one year, and I went to Philadelphia, and I was recommended to this particular gentleman, and he decided that what was needed was radiation treatment. Now, I had no idea what that meant, but I went into this room with this big machine, and he tied me in a chair so I couldn't move.
There you go.
It scared the hell out of me, I might tell you that. And then two consecutive days, he put that big machine right on the edge of my shoulder, and he turned it on for 6 seconds for 2 days in a row, and I have never had another problem with that left shoulder. So I don't know what he did, but he blew something out of those joints that shouldn't have been there.
I'll be done.
Yeah, remarkable.
Interesting. Dean, let's reflect back on a few of your PGA Tour wins. I think your first professional win on the PGA Tour came in 1969 at the Texas Open Invitational at Pecan Valley Country Club.
Right, yeah. Back up a little bit. When I started on the tour, I went out to the West Coast, and I played, I finished, I think, fourth in the Crosby tournament. And then I got in a playoff with Arnold at the Bob Hope Desert Classic, and I actually won the playoff, but it's not recorded that way. First hole of the playoff had a huge gallery, and I hit it in there about 15 feet from the hole, and Arnold flew it over the pin, over the green, and behind the green. And there was out of bounds. And the gallery's back there, and hit the gallery and bounced back in. He made par and then beat me on the next hole.
Yeah.
So I had one of those Arnold Palmer experiences where
early in your career.
That's right. That's right.
That happened occasionally, didn't it?
Oh yes, it did.
Who'd you partner with at the Crosby, Dean?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, one in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
You know, I don't remember a long time ago, but I finished fourth, and then a couple weeks later finished and lost in a playoff. So that was the start of my career in 68, you know.
Yeah. You played with a Dean, didn't you, at Crosby, Bruce?
I did play with a Dean. My partner for 10 years was Dean Martin.
All right.
Which was a fun week each year to spend a week with him.
So what's your memories of that win at Texas?
I wasn't playing very well. I remember playing the final round with, you can help me here, Bruce, the two brothers from Michigan.
Hill?
Yeah, Dave Hill. I played with Dave
Hill.
Yeah, Dave Hill. I remember about middle of the last round, I'm either leading or one back, and he went to 1 tee, and I think Dave said to me something. He said, Beeman, he says, if you didn't have a short game, you'd vault right into the 90s. But I got around and kind of snuck in there and won the tournament. Didn't play very well, but I scored well.
I want to tell you that Mr. Dave Hill was one fine player too. He was a heck of a player, David.
Dave Hill was could really play. Yes, he could.
Yeah.
We just talked about him last week with Tony Jacklin, kind of reminiscing about the 1970 U.S. Open at Hazeltine, and of course he had plenty of Dave Hill memories as well.
For yeah. That.
Well, I got one for there because I was there. You'll love us. I went there early and played practice round, and I went in the locker room and Dave Hill was there, and I said to Dave, "Hey, Dave, I said this is some golf course." I said they really ruined a great farm here, you know.
He was pretty outspoken that week, wasn't he?
And he did that. He said the same. He didn't quote me, but he said it to the press. And I think Joe Dye fined him $10,000 or something.
And you might have fed him the line, huh?
That's right. I fed him the line. Yeah, I was hooting and hollering in the locker room, and he picked it up.
That's funny.
Well, the next year you won the Greater Milwaukee Open. As a former Milwaukeean, at least for a few years, that's sort of near and dear to my heart. That was at North Shore Country Club by 3 over Don Massengale, Ted Hayes Jr., and Richard Crawford.
Yeah, I played very well that week. I remember hitting the ball well and putting well, and I won by 3 shots. And you don't usually. Not too many tournaments do you win by 3 shots. So I really led the field and played very well.
And you were going to play the Open Championship at the Old Course probably that year, weren't you?
I was, but that was 1970, and I wasn't playing that great in the springtime. And, I decided not to go over and play in the British Open.
Yeah. You won the Quad Cities in 1972 at Crow Valley Country Club by 1 over none other than Tom Watson.
TW, yeah.
And the previous year, I guess you'd won that as well, but it was not an official tour event. Is that your recollection?
Yeah, what happened there is that Quad Cities was going to get on the schedule. In a year, they put on a smaller event that didn't have enough prize money to make it official. And I was on the board as an advisor to the board, and the board members, Commissioner Joe Dye asked board members to go and support this tournament because if it was successful, we'd have a full event. So I went and played and won it. I think Tom Watson finished second. I'm one of his first events. And then the following year, it became a full-fledged event, and I won it again the following year and when it was an official event, yes.
And then in 1973, you won the Shrine Robinson Open Golf Classic. That was the last playing of that event. You must have really liked Crawford County Country Club.
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting story because that spring in May, I was on the board of the policy board. The then Commissioner Joe Dye and Paul Austin, who was chairman of Coca-Cola Company, who was our chairman of the board, asked me to go to the golf course. This was in Memphis, and drive to the golf course with them, and he did. And during that car ride, they announced to me personally and confidentially that Joe Dye was going to retire in the next year when the end of his 5-year contract was up. And then they asked me, they said that we want you to become commissioner. And, of course, I had just come off of my second surgery on my left hand. In November of late October, beginning of November of the previous year, I didn't get to play any golf until March or April. And I told them that I'd never done anything, that I quit when I wasn't doing well, and I wasn't doing well. I'd had a hard time getting back and getting my game back. I was struggling, and I said I just couldn't walk away after my lifetime in golf and walk away defeated. So I told them to go ahead and form a committee and look for somebody to commission, because I wasn't going to do it. I was going to keep competing until I was successful. So they put a committee together to look for a new commissioner, started interviewing people, and then later that year I won that tournament, which made me exempt for everything. British Open and U.S. Open and Masters and two-year exemption on the tour. And I went from there to California to play. I think we were playing up in Napa Valley. And I remember sitting down and had one of those apartments up there that they rented to the players by myself. And thought about what I do the rest of my life here. And now I got started 10 years late on the tour. Had the injury. It had all kinds of intrigue in where I was then. Where was I going to spend the rest of my life? And I decided that I could contribute more to golf. I was never going to be based on what I had done up till now and what other players had done. I was never going to be the best player in the world. I decided that, I called Paul Austin and Coca-Cola Company and Joe Dye and told them if they now wanted me to consider me to be commissioner, I'd do that. I'd won a tournament. I could walk away with my head high and feel that I hadn't walked away defeated. And so that's when they had a big meeting in December and interviewed, I think, six people for commissioner, and that's when they appointed me as commissioner.
Well, they did a hell of a job, I can tell you that. They picked the right guy at the right time.
You know, Dean, in the absence of that second wrist injury, you think you might have played a little longer?
No doubt I probably would have, yes.
So you never know how things work and why they work, do you? So
life has its ups and downs and ins and outs that you can't maybe ever calculate.
Dean, for our listeners, why don't you just remind everybody of who Joe Dye was, a little bit about what he did, and because he was the first commissioner, which probably happened right after the PGA Tour players broke away, right, from the PGA of America.
Yes, in 1968, the players broke away from the PGA of America and formed their own organization. The name of the tour was the Tournament Players Division of the PGA of America, and the board hired Joe Dye, who was then executive director of the USGA, to be the first commissioner.
And Joe had had that job for 34 years, I believe, before taking the first commissioner job.
That's correct, yes.
You think about a guy that who'd been in the amateur, you know, side of the golf for so many years, and then to actually accept the job, running the pros side of it, was I thought was a very interesting choice.
Well, he, you know, the USGA is an organization that's not a business organization. It's an association of independent clubs, and Joe administered basically the biggest activity for somebody who is the executive director of the USGA is running their events. And they had the Open, they had the Amateur, they had the Ladies Amateur, they had the Junior Tournament. So they, you know, he was an administrator of golf tournaments, and of course, that's That's what the tour.
That's what golf.
That's
right.
All. That's what the tour. Only. That's only what the tour did, which is it scheduled tournaments. It tried to get them on television, and it sent officials out to officiate the tournament. So that's what the tour did, very much like the USGA. There were very similar organizations.
So, Dean, why don't you set the stage for our listeners? We'll take everybody back to 1974. The tour, as we knew it, was fairly young, quite different. Why don't you just describe for our listeners what you were coming into? What did the tour look like? How it was organized? What were some of the things that you saw early on that probably needed to be done to take it to the next level?
Well, the tour in 1974 was, I say, very similar to the USGA. It ran an association of players. It held four meetings a year. It administered the, it hired officials to officiate golf tournaments, and it scheduled golf tournaments of local organizations, and it tried to get as many as they could on television. That's what it did. And to give you a perspective, golf was a minor sport back then. Clearly a minor sport. As a matter of fact, bowling had more events on television and got more money for television than golf did. So golf was very much a minor sport. Of course, been an amateur golf for many, many years, and then professional for a few years. I ran a business, insurance business, with my partner. I understood business, and I thought that the tour, even though the tour had very famous golfers, Arnold and Jack and Gary and prior years to that, the Caspers and Hogans and Sneeds, been around a long time, but it was still a very minor sport. And I thought that golf had much more value than that, and that that I thought I could make a difference. That's why I took the job.
Yeah, how prepared did you really feel you were at age 36 taking on that sort of a role?
You know, I never thought of that. I'd never done anything in my life that I didn't think I was capable of doing. Anything I accepted the responsibility for or thought about and envisioned doing, I never thought I couldn't do it. In anything, whether it was playing golf or playing football in the younger years, or being successful on the PGA Tour, or being commissioner of the PGA Tour.
So you mentioned the events. A lot of these events, the tour really didn't have the controlling rights to these. These were, you know, Crosby and Williams and Hope and some of these guys with their own tournaments. And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, actually, the reality was that the tour actually owned the television rights. They didn't exercise ownership of them, but they actually owned them. The players owned their own rights, and when they joined the tour, they assigned the rights, their personal rights, to the tour. So the tour actually owned them. But because it was very difficult for golf to get on television, and make it a payable and a financial windfall for the networks. And most of the tournaments that got on television were the celebrity tournaments. Crosby, who had an association with, I believe, ABC, and Bob Hope and NBC, and, of course, Dean Martin and Andy Williams, and all these events got on television from a financially marginal standpoint, under the influence of these super celebrities. And that's how most of the events were on the air. There were a few events like the Westchester Classic because it was New York, and that's where the networks were, and a lot of corporations were there. Some of those got on, but very, very small rights fees, the celebrity events that got themselves on television got most of the money. The tour got a little bit. None of the other tournaments got anything. And the tournament that, you know, Andy Williams tournament, they got them on, or the Crosby tournament, most of the money went to them. Because golf is a low-rated sport, the television ratings are low, and the cost is high. The problem was enormous, because back then in the 70s, you could telecast any other sport, baseball, basketball, football. It cost $25,000 to produce it, because you only had one or two cameras in the stadium that was already there. You just plug them in and somebody walks in at a booth and that's it. To do a golf tournament, you have to build towers. They have to string the cables. They have to bring trucks in for the equipment. It costs $250,000 to do a tournament, and you could do a football game for $25,000, or a baseball or a basketball game, and all these other sports had a broader audience and a bigger rating. So we had small ratings and high cost. And therefore, it was almost uneconomical to get a tournament on television. It was a huge problem. So that was a situation that we faced at the time.
Dean, how significant was it when you decided to convert the tour into a 501c6 organization? That must have had a big move as far as the tour was concerned.
Well, at the time, it didn't have a really big move, although, in later years, as we became more successful, it's become huge. But back then, the tour was a profit-making organization. When I took the job as commissioner, I had 2 months between the time they hired me and it was March 1st until I actually became commissioner. So I had 2 months. I lived in Washington, D.C. So I commuted to New York to Joe Dye's office at least 3 days a week and read everything in the office. And I did read all the original incorporating documents and all the files. Because I was in the insurance business and did business with nonprofits in Washington, D.C., and I'd gotten approval of a deferred comp program for a nonprofit organization. I saw what kind of taxes we paid. We didn't have a lot of money, but we paid over 5 years about $500,000 in taxes. And I wondered, having dealt with in the Washington area where most big associations are, and I'd done business with them in the insurance business, I thought that we were wasting money on taxes, because we were, I thought, clearly capable of being a nonprofit. And I went to our lawyers in New York who had engineered the pull away from the USGA and were our lawyers, and sat down with the guy there, a fellow named Gates, Sam Gates, and asked him why it was that the tour was a Delaware for-profit corporation and not a nonprofit. And of course, he's a big, here's a little tiny organization. The tour was nothing. And he represented these major corporations. So basically, in so many words, he didn't say it this way, but I can tell you that's how I received it. Basically, he said, "Sonny," he says, "why don't you go run your tournaments and let me take care of the big stuff?"
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah. So I went back to Washington, D.C., and I had hired a lawyer to help me do the deferred comp with this fellow that I knew who was president of the third class mail users, and said to him, you know, explain the PGA Tour and what it was like. And I said, is there any reason why we can't be a nonprofit? He says, no, there's no reason you can't be. Problem is, you've been paying taxes for 5 years and there's nobody in the local guy that you go to is going to give up the money that you've been paying the federal government. So you're going to have to go to court. You're going to have to fight them. And it'll take you a couple of years, but the answer is you're going to win. So I said, okay. So I went back to the board and explained it to him and said, I think we should do this long term. They agreed. So we hired my friend in Washington to file for a nonprofit. And I remember I was flying to Phoenix for a meeting, and I had the papers to be filed, and I took them with me to read on the airplane. As I'm in the airplane, I was reading through it, and I called the attorney on the phone, and when I got to Phoenix, put a quarter. She didn't have cell phones. I put a quarter in the phone in Phoenix, and I had to have more quarters because it was going to take me a few minutes. And I said to him, I said, Bob, now as I understand, you can be successful here. I've read all the papers. Said, yeah. I said, well, what's it going to cost us to fight this for 2 or 3 years? He said, well, probably going to cost you a couple $100,000 in attorney's fees before it's all over. I said, fine. I said, well, what would happen, Bob, if somebody decided to compete with the PGA Tour and do their own tour and do their own association? He says, well, they could do that. I said, well, fine. Well, Bob, change those papers. We're going to create an organization to go in competition with the tour. You put yourself on it and put your secretary and your wife and or anybody else's board of directors and file it. So we filed it and got a return, got approval for a new organization by return mail in 30 days. So once we had that, we transferred our board to that to those officers and went to the IRS, and they gave us a tax-free exchange for the profit making. And it took 30 days and cost $2,500 in attorney's fees, and we were nonprofit in less than 60 days.
Isn't that something?
I'll be darned. Dean, from our conversation thus far, you sure strike me as a structured guy, a guy that works a plan, a guy that sets goals for himself. So as you came into this job and got situated, what do you reflect back on as perhaps the top three things that you saw that you needed to set out and get done?
Well, I knew the tour had to be run as a business. I saw the fact that television was key to success. If you could find a way of monetizing golf on television as other sports had done in the NFL, baseball, football, all had major contracts that really supported their sport, and golf had nothing to do, when I became commissioner, financially supporting golf. It was the volunteers and the amount of money they raised locally that put all the money into the pot for the players to play for. There was literally very little television money going to each event. So I knew that would be the key to our success, to find out how to make golf pay from a television standpoint, that it make it valuable. It's not just doing a favor for their favorite celebrity that happened to be associated with the network. And there was a huge roadblock to it all at the time. And that was, all the three networks, and there were only three networks back then. You know, we were only dealing with ABC, CBS, and NBC. And the big problem was all three networks had a policy against on-camera or announcer on saying anything commercially unless it was a commercial break and somebody was paying for it. So if a for local tournament had a, you know, a commercial sponsor that was helping them pay for their event, the cameraman could not show anybody's signage. As a matter of fact, there was a big hurrah. You, Bruce, you'll know when a manna came up and paid, you know, a guy made the cut, and the manna guy would come in on Saturday and give you a hat and pay you, what, $1,000 or $500 or something like that. Well, the networks went crazy because they didn't want to ever show and give a man a free ride. Yeah. So that was a huge problem. And I broke the ice, basically. Rune Arledge never agreed with me, but I convinced CBS that if they would allow commercial intrusion verbally or on camera, that I could get corporations to put up a huge amount of money and actually support the television so they could actually make money.
Right.
And Rune Arledge was completely opposed to it, and he hated me from day one. ABC never did golf with the tour because Rune Arledge walked away from it. They did most of our golf back then. And I converted both NBC and CBS to what you now see as title sponsors. And the title sponsor, I'll tell you where it is today. It was not this way because we didn't have all of the communications and texting and all that as we have today, but it was still important and still valuable. We found out that if you calculated the value, if a tournament would abandon its local name and adapt only a title sponsor's name purely so nobody could call the event anything else, it wouldn't be the Travelers Hartford Open, it would just be the Travelers, that so that it was inconvenient to call it anything else but the title name, that we calculated the value that the camera that showed Hartford or Travelers on the air, and the fact that every newspaper in the company covered all the golf tournaments, and on the Agate page, when they ran down who's leading the tournament, the title to that tournament was the Travelers, and on local television sports programs, it wasn't the Hartford Open, it was the Travelers. When you calculated all that, a title sponsor who put up, whether it was back then $2 million or now $12 million, they would get three times the value of their investment because of all the other associated publicity that went with their name on the tournament, not just the ratings for the couple hours they were on Sunday. And once we broke that ice and showed the networks and showed the title sponsors that they could get three times the if they spent the same amount of money on television, they're only going to get what the ratings give. If they spend it on a golf tournament, they're going to get three times the value. And so all of a sudden, golf became a profit maker on television. And unlike other sports, most television networks don't make money on other sports. The sports are just as sophisticated as the networks are, and they will keep increasing the rights fees so that the networks don't lose money, but they don't make money. that the sport makes all the money. And major sports on Sunday are on the air, and as you will see to even today and way back then, they promote the events on prime time where they make their money. So sports are used as a promotion for their prime time events. So we were able to take golf. Not only can they use the time on the air to promote their big making money making, we showed them how to actually make money doing a telecast in golf, and that transformed it. And that is that's what we figured out, and we needed to break the barrier to do that. One of the ways we broke the barrier is about that time it was happening. ESPN just had been established, and the tour, we bought time on ESPN and did our own telecast and got a title sponsor and showed the networks that if we could do it and make money at it, they could big time make money at it. And that's how it was transformed.
So, Dean, the transformation of the television model, did that predate or sort of coincide with then the move toward the tour events and title sponsors having this philanthropic focus?
It happened just about the same time. The conversion to charity aspects of golf. The charity aspects wasn't brand new. A lot of tournaments had charities. You know, the Crosby had their foundation up there, and they had charities. We had promoters that ran tournaments that made the money, but we had, you know, for instance, the Hartford Open was run by the JCs, and so was the Greensboro Open.
Century Club in Dallas.
Right. So there were a charitable aspect out there, but it wasn't mandatory, and it didn't and it wasn't across the board, okay? So I decided as we came up with the concept for television to monetize golf on television. Is what I call it, and make it work for everybody so that everybody won. The title sponsor won. He got three times his value. The networks won because they could finally put golf on at a higher operating cost than any other sport but still make money at it. And we won because we were getting rights fees to add to our purses. So it was a win-win-win for everybody. As we got into that, I decided that as that was going to, all the money was being plowed into increasing prize money. You know, when I played on a tour, there wasn't a tournament. There was only one tournament that had a bigger prize money than $250,000. That was Westchester. That's the only one.
Yeah. Right.
And so I decided that if we were successful, and I thought we were going to be, and I was projecting down the road 4 or 5 years, where instead of playing for $100,000, we'd be playing for $250,000, $300,000. We'd be, you know, 5 years and I would be paying for $500,000 a week. But if you're involved in operating golf tournaments, you know you can't do it without volunteers. And I know no tournament didn't have 1,000 volunteers. I didn't see a successful model that the players would come into town, volunteers would take their vacation off of work to work for the tournament, and the players walking out at the end of the week with all the money and going home, and the community left with nothing. So I decided that for the long term, that we should create a policy, which I presented to the board, which they ultimately agreed to, that no tournament in the future. We wouldn't cancel anybody. We wouldn't throw anybody away who was a who'd been helping us become mildly successful. But in the future, we wouldn't sign a new contract with anybody that 100% of the proceeds of the tournament didn't go to charity to reward the volunteers that were completely necessary to operate. And that's how it started.
Yeah.
Dean, I can give you some numbers because I've got them in front of me. In 1974, there was less than $1 million went to charity, right? In 2019, there was $204.3 million raised for charity, and that took the tour's contribution to charity through the golf tournaments to $3.05 billion. What a milestone. And then last year, just the tour championship alone, $3.56 million went to charity. So that was what a great success that whole thing has been, Dean. Thank you.
Yeah, it turns out, Bruce, and it's a big win for everybody, for a community to hold a tournament. The volunteers can feel really good about what they're doing for their community. Specific charities within the community are being helped and being financed, and the tour players are winning too. It's one of the things that I've always believed as I was back in the old days selling insurance, that if both sides aren't a winner, if I'm the only one that's winning because I get a commission,
not going to last long.
It ain't going to last long. So you to have a sustaining business deal, both sides have to win for it to sustain itself. And I think, Bruce, one thing that people need to understand, that the PGA Tour has raised over $3 billion, more than all other sports combined. But two things. One is individual players like yourself, Bruce, who have your own foundation. And almost every player on the tour who's reasonably successful has his own charity that he raises money for locally.
Right.
Nobody's ever accumulated that. My guess is the players doing on their own have raised just as much money as the tour as an organization has.
I think you're correct, too. There's a lot of... Just like you said, just about everyone has got involved in trying to help the game through their own charities, and that's what we've done.
Yeah.
Bruce, why don't you take our listeners back to 1974, if you can transport yourself back then. Give us the players' perspective. What were some of the issues you guys were talking about in the locker room as it related to tour operations and what you felt you needed to have the product improve for the player themselves?
I think when Dean come along, I think just about everybody that was playing on the tour in those days could see the little changes that were happening that ultimately, you know, 5 or 10 years later become the big changes. I don't think there's a player that's ever played in the, the 70s and 80s that could say more about what the job that Dean has done, the 20 years that he was a commissioner. We didn't always agree with one another. Dean and I have had a conversation or two about, differences of opinion, but the overall strength of the tour has become quite remarkable. And then you just look at the players and what they've been able to have in their pension plans today. It's remarkable to think that for instance, I'll give you an example. I don't know what Tiger Woods is going to end up when he finishes his career on the tour, but my sense, Dean, it could be close to $100 million.
I don't know what the numbers are, but yes, I would agree with you. And I've gotten several letters in the last couple of years by players who are now retired who I didn't never realize back then what it would mean to them today.
Right.
That they have something, even though they're not no longer competitive on the tour, that they have what we call a deferred compensation plan.
Right.
Set aside for them. And there's probably today, Bruce, maybe somewhere between $1.5 billion and $2 billion sitting there that a player owns.
Correct. I could give you an example of how it's improved. When I went off the regular tour, the payment that I got off the pension, and I have no animosity about this at all, but I got paid $4,600. That was what my pension was off the PGA Tour. I played on the senior tour for about 9 years, and I was allowed then to defer some of my prize money, which, thank you, Dean, you allowed us to do that. When I left the senior tour, it was nearly $400,000. And then we could take that when we stopped playing, we could then take it after we turned 70 and a half, as many years as up to 15 years, we could take it out on an annual basis. So that gives you an idea. So me being at 84, think of the guys that are only in their, you know, their mid-20s today, and if they have a successful career, goodness knows how much money they're going to retire with. It's quite fascinating, really.
Right.
Thank you, Commissioner Beaman.
Yes, sure,
that's
sir.
The sentiment of many of the former players.
You'll enjoy this. I can remember when we made a presentation to the players about this deferred comp and that we were filing for it and try to get it. It was difficult. It took us a couple of years to get it approved. But one of the players stood up in the player meeting and says, "Wait a minute, why don't we just play for it?"
That is pretty funny.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle. Quiet.